Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where today we're asking, how do you write an obituary? We sadly seem to be in a bit of a golden age for the demise of some cultural greats. Last year we said goodbye to David Bowie, Prince, Leonard Cohen and George Michael, as you know, and it made us wonder. We also admire obituaries. They tend to be the best bits of the newspaper, factual yet anecdotal, elegant yet concise. They're good writing. We also wondered how obituaries work editorially, who writes them, when, and how many are on a newspaper's files at any one time, and what sort of code administers to obituaries. Thankfully, there is a slightly old-fashioned feel to the quality of the writing and research that goes into obits. While the front pages rush and the gossip pages gush, the obituary is the sober assessment of a life well-lived or otherwise, and most are both. But perhaps the obit hopes to remake a world of well-mannered old soldiers and charmingly dishevelled rockers that never quite existed in the first place. We shall see. We'll be doing this in two bits. In bit one, we'll speak to the former obits editor at London's Daily Telegraph, regarded by many as the best written obituaries in the business, and by Will Hodgkinson, rock and pop critic for The Times, who'll tell us the difference between excited hackery and considered reflection when it comes to mourning and appraising pop's lies. That is all in the service of the question, how do you write an obituary? Coming up on Culture with me, Robert Bound.
I'm going to go public with you with this because it bothers me. One time, about 2 years ago, or maybe, I got a call from a New York Times reporter. And he called me. I said, oh, I'm sorry to bother you, Mr. Tlis, but I was assigned to do some information to be used in your obituary. I said, oh, well, do you want to make a date? Come over see me? And he said, no. I said, no? No. Well, how can you write an obituary if you don't even know the person? He said, well, I have your work. I said, my work isn't all of me. I mean, I have a life outside of my work. I am something more than my little scribblings done in private. If I was going to write about somebody, an obituary in advance, and it's what it is, an advance obituary, I wouldn't want to talk to them on the phone. I want to go see them, what they look like. They would have to say, my involvement is so intensely connected to what I'm doing that I take off my clothes, as I did in Thy Neighbor's Wife, that I convert with well-known killers and gangsters, as I did in the book about the mafia family called Honor Thy Father, that I hang around with a wretched, perverted voyeur and describe him in a negligent and unforgettably culpable moment where he watches murder and does nothing about it. The people I associate with, not only associate with, but take all the time to write about with such care and with such dedication to doing my very best with prose. And some of these people are so disreputable, so disgusting, so, you know, I'm non-judgmental. The fact that what is the responsibility, one might ask, for the chronicler, for the observer, me? Does he not take any moral stand with people who are clearly immoral or disgusting? No, that question should be in my obituary.
That was the always brilliant writer Gay Talese on how he thinks his obituary should be written. But unfortunately, we don't all get to decide how we're immortalised in words after we go. That responsibility lies with the obituary writer. Now we're going to meet Harry de Ketville at The Telegraph, who's our man on the inside. So firstly, who qualifies for an obit? Harry reveals all.
The only qualification is that one's life interests the reader, and that is the supreme qualification, is what readers find curious, interesting and engaging. And so the Telegraph obituaries page has featured everyone from members of the aristocracy to members of the armed forces to priests who minister to the pimps and prostitutes of London Soho or circus lion tamers. You name it, we've run it, because We have very Catholic taste in that way. All human life is there and we celebrate that.
And that's presumably part and parcel. There is a part to an obituary where if you don't know the person, then you learn something. There is a kind of nudge your neighbour on the tube aspect to a good obituary, surely. Or there is something that you remember to quote down the pub later. There's a lot of perhaps forgotten knowledge about lives not forgotten.
That's certainly true. All obituaries, whether whoever they're covering, have a huge amount of biographical information in there. And we remember them, we celebrate them, as we are doing now, for their jolliness and their entertainment value. But when I started doing obits, I was told that they have more facts per line than any other form of journalism, and that's certainly true. You know, dates, places, the who, when, why, where, what of great lives, of all lives, are recorded in them, and so they are hugely informative before you even begin to get round to the business of them being hugely entertaining. So the structure and style of obituaries, those two components have to lock together, but the structure and the information bolted onto that structure is the prerequisite.
This is a great test of one's journalistic prowess. As you said, there's more facts per line than any other piece of writing you're ever going to do or that turns up in your newspaper. And it has to be carried off with a certain amount of pizzazz and writerliness as well. How is the obituary page? How has it been regarded? How is it still regarded? Is it one of the jewels in the crown of the paper?
It is well regarded and hugely entertaining to do, actually, because the singular difference between writing obituaries and almost any other form of journalism is that people want to talk to you, which is a huge boon. People want family members, friends, acquaintances, by and large. When it comes to obituaries, they want to tell you personal stories about the subject. And when people are alive, the sad truth is you're usually after them for a story which they may not be willing or wishing you to chase them for. And so you're constantly trying to sit on doorsteps, knock on doors, get to friends who don't want to talk to you. Whereas when people have died and you're ringing someone up to get information about them from their families and friends, those family and friends are usually all too pleased to talk to you. And indeed, it's extraordinary. I remember taking a call once from a woman saying, "Oh, my husband has died and I wanted to know if you'd be interested in an obituary about him." And I said, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry to hear that, as I tended to do. And can you tell me a little bit about his life and what he did?" And she went on to explain exactly what he did and his impact on life. I said, "Well, I think that's terribly interesting. That sounds very much like we might be interested in an obit. Can I just ask one last question? When did he die?" And she said, "Oh, about 15 minutes ago. He's right next to me here in our bedroom."
So, oh, wow.
So, I mean, people, it is high up on their list of things to do once people have died, is to get in contact with us.
It's a sort of touchstone, isn't it? There is something of, if you're the sort of person that would get your obituary written up in the Telegraph, then you're a certain sort of person. There is pride from beyond the grave, possibly.
Huge cachet in, you know, not always for positive reasons. I mean, there are the obituaries of notorious as well as famous characters in the Telegraph. But also there are people who assume that they will get an obituary who simply might not, because they are slightly establishment figures, or, you know, they think. But they've actually, when you come to it, you think, well, what has this chap or this woman actually done that's really going to make our readers sit up, and what is it? And you think, oh, gosh. And so the really delicate conversations you sometimes have to have are with the families of those who assume wrongly that their beloved is going to get an obituary, and I'm afraid isn't. That's the hardest conversation you have to have.
So you mentioned that Telegraph readers will write in and say, well, you might be interested in my husband, just even if it's weirdly the first phone call that they make. That is definitely heartening for the brand of the Telegraph obituary, I suppose. But what about the writers? You presumably, when David Bowie dies, you commission a different person to write it than if a wing commander dies. Or maybe not. Maybe it is part of the skill of the obituary writer that they can turn their hand to anything.
The answer is a bit of both. We certainly have a huge number of specialists who know their business and their part of the world very, very well indeed. So we will have obituarists who specialise in the Air Force or the Army or the Navy. So each service, we'll have people we turn to who can write about intelligence and spying. We have people who we can turn to who can write about archaeology or extreme sports. We have someone who knows more about circuses than you would care to mention. We have people who know a great deal about the aristocracy, and equally we have people who know a lot about the demi-monde, as I mentioned, of Soho. And so, you know, cultivating people who can write well and people who know their world very well is very much a part of the obituary editor's job. And then on the desk, on the obituary's desk, of course, it's our job to make sure that the words that come in are polished and good, and to write lots of them ourselves, even as generalists, because, yes, you know, not every obituary requires total specialist training, especially if lots of information is coming from family and friends.
And it's interesting to mention someone like the barman at the Colony Rooms, because one of the jobs of the obits page is to shine a light on the people that were the nexus of all the connections that formed during a particular art movement or particular age and era of, for example, Soho or whatever it might be. This is part of the job of the obits page, presumably, to piece back social history, not just people that have lived and then died.
Exactly. You know, we are not exclusively about achievement. You don't have to be a Nobel Prize winner or the Archbishop of Canterbury to get in the obits page of the Telegraph, although, you know, it helps. But, I remember doing a great obit of, I hope I'm getting this right, of Johnny Moak, who was key in popularising the Mini Moak. And that obit was all about the King's Road at a certain period of time and the connections around the King's Road and the art shops and a point in time where fashionable London met with quite a seedy kind of semi-criminal element. And, you know, one forgets totally about that social period.
OK, Harry, I've got two quick ones. One is a matter of housekeeping. One is a matter of euphemism. How many obituaries do you have in the bag? I imagine that behind the obits desk at the Telegraph, there is a gargantuan filing cabinet of almost finished obituaries of the great, the good, and, as you mentioned, the slightly unknown.
Yup. How many exactly? I couldn't tell you. Shall we say thousands?
Amazing. And we're not going to ask you to do the death clock thing and kind of, you know, give us odds on who's next and all the rest of it. But obviously, there are ones that are closer to the top of the pile than others. And how often does that process get reviewed?
In quite an ad hoc way. You know, we stay on top of the news as well as anybody else. And, you know, people aren't well, or sometimes you look at the birthdays and you realise, blimey, that person's a bit older than I sort of had thought. And, you know, it's a refreshingly realistic attitude to life and death. And people, on the whole, I find are tremendously unsqueamish about it.
And just finally, obituaries have been a source of amusement because of the euphemism with which they employed phrases like bon viveur to mean people that liked probably seven glasses of sherry too many over lunch, possibly served by the barman at the Colony Rooms, who knows. Although kind of the code of writing and the politeness perhaps of the register of a lot of writing has changed, and we're all a lot more colloquial even at the Telegraph and even at the Telegraph on the obits desk, is there still a bit of a code to writing an obituary of what we might call complex characters?
I would say that there is less a code than there used to be, and some of it is good and some of it is less good. So, for instance, I think one of the great things is that, which happened, you know, really quite recently, is that in obits, when we started out, the great sort of euphemism was to say that he remained a bachelor, or he was unmarried, and that was to say he was gay. And now, happily, even in what you might think is fusty old Telegraph, we say X lived happily with his partner Y for 30 years, and, you know, they had a country house in Sussex, and it just, in an entirely un-euphemistic, entirely untroubled, unfussed way. And so some euphemisms just go, and go for happy reasons, in that we don't really care anymore. We don't think it's a subject which needs to be described euphemistically. I think the complex characters, that issue is when someone's really unpleasant. And, you know, they're very interesting, but basically everyone knows that they were a deeply unpleasant person. And the extent to which you try and communicate the fact that they were deeply unpleasant is
a thesaurus-busting job, possibly.
Well, it's just something you don't want to... The last thing you want to do is you don't want to really upset the widow or the family of someone. You don't want to get that call saying, you know, my mother has just lost her husband and now she's read your obituary and is in tears again. And, you know, that is totally understandable. So we have a duty of care in a way, but we don't write obituaries for family members. We write them for the readers, and therefore occasionally there are times when there is a conflict there, when you have to describe someone as in a way. And so there, I guess, the euphemism and the sort of hinting at does come into it. And you reach, as you say, for the thesaurus.
That was Harry de Ketville, comment editor and former Obits editor at The Telegraph. Now, the reason for this talk about Obits is unsurprisingly due to the number of high-profile deaths in the past year. None has been better documented than the death of David Bowie. When he passed away last January, the news went into overdrive, covering his life and legacy, and it's a topic that hasn't really been out of the news even a year later. Last week was 1 year on. Will Hodgkinson, chief rock and pop critic for The Times, joined me in the studio to discuss how the mourning of Bowie has been played out in the press since his obit was published, and whether the old dictum of an obit as a celebration of a life has ever wobbled into the realm of hagiography.
She'll come.
At the moment, I think we're still in a kind of mourning period stroke honeymoon period where we're in love with everything Bowie did. If you criticise him, it's seen as a kind of deliberate provocation, you know, slightly disingenuous.
Yeah.
He hasn't yet got to the stage of being assessed soberly.
That's a really interesting point, because there is this point in the death of celebrities where once the jokes come out, often people kind of go, oh, it's too soon. And although no one's making jokes here, there is an element of, there is a time at which it is too soon to, as you say, have a sober appraisal of a person's career, of a person's life and career. And maybe we haven't reached that point yet. I mean, thinking about someone like Bob Dylan, who none more so has kind of created the culture and is still adding to it. But it would be strange to sort of pretend that he was always a wonderful live performer just because he happened to die yesterday, for example, right? This is the
kind
of thing you're
talking about. That's exactly it. Well, I mean, the obvious comparison with Bowie is Lady Diana. She, you know, a figure who somehow came to represent the underdog, even though they weren't underdogs, obviously.
Yeah.
But they represented anyone who felt slightly marginalised. And the very strange thing with Bowie is that if you think about when he really broke through, which was the early 70s with Hunky Dory, after Hunky Dory, you know, Starman and Ziggy Stardust, he was a freak. He was terrifying middle England. He was very, very unusual. Well, everything that becomes unusual, I guess, you know, everything that is once unusual eventually becomes part of the establishment. At the moment, you couldn't get more of an establishment figure than Bowie. It would be, you know, it'd be outrageous to criticise him.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, it would be seen as the wrong thing to do. So it's the establishment viewpoint to worship Bowie, which is strange if you think about the where he came from.
In terms of the world of writing about this, whether you're reappraising a career, or simply you're on deadline and your editor wants something on Bowie to mark the year since his death, what are the arguments flitting around either within the newspaper or within music writer circles, or just in terms of your own head? Do you have to sort of scratch your head and think, God, what else can we possibly really say?
Yeah, you do. I mean, there's things that you could go into detail of. So you could look at an album like Low and you could say that this was, one of the first examples of a totally huge pop star doing something completely experimental and unusual and, you know, sort of rewriting the rules of music almost. So you could look at that. Or what I think you could look at now is who owns Bowie? You know, where's it going? I mean, last weekend I went to two concerts, which were both Bowie fests. The first one was really good. It was at the Jazz Cafe, very small, and it's a bunch of very, very good jazz musicians playing songs of Bowie. And that's where I kind of thought, okay, this is the future, you know, the idea of the classical.
Yeah, and you kind of feel actually also that's where so much of this stuff was going. You know, there was so much more saxophone, there was so much more brush drums on those later records.
That's a good point, yeah.
There was quite a lot of jazz influence on
that. It was going that way. But I think, they were doing mostly of the classics, but it was a sort of, you could sort of see this is how it could work. The following day was not so good, and this is the big one with Brixton Academy. It was organised by Gary Oldman, and it had everyone from Tom Chaplin, from Keen, to Tony Hadley.
Oh, Tony Hadley, yeah. Right, yeah.
So you had all these people, weird mix, and you think, well, what's the connection? The musicians were all Bowie musicians, but from different periods. And so you'd have, you know, the original keyboardist from the Ziggy era with Gail Ann Dorsey, who was his bassist for the last two decades of his life. They weren't used to playing together, so it sounded a bit of a mess. The people coming on, you're thinking, well, what's their connection with Bowie? And it's like now, with a figure like that, everyone needs to, it's like we're all children of Bowie. We've all got to own him somehow. And that's where we're at, I think, with pop stars dying, is, you know, what's the connection people have? Who's got the right to write? Well, we've all got the right to write about them if we want to. You see what I'm saying? You know, yeah. I kind of feel that that's what's going to happen. It's going to be more and more of a kind of people around a major figure are going to sort of claim their ownership of them in some way.
Now, there's an interesting thing on the subject of obituaries specifically. The obituary is an interesting, disinterested piece of journalism often. So when you're dealing with someone of the stature of David Bowie, it's quite instructive to read the simple obituary, which might not be written even by a rock critic. It might be written just by the obituaries editor, and it might have, if it has to sort of stand the same rigor as if a wing commander had died, then actually it makes for quite interesting reading, because it is not necessarily hagiography, it is biography.
That's very true.
And it's quite a different and instructive thing, because within the music press, no one didn't like Bowie. You can like the not very good bits, but generally you can't say he was an underperforming performer.
No, you can't say we didn't have any talent.
Exactly.
That would be a bit silly.
So do you feel that you have to sort of slightly kick against the pricks and sort of in order to say something interesting?
My job will be, when he died and I got the call, I think it was 6 o'clock in the morning or something, my job was not to write the obituary. As you say, they're obituary writers and they're sober and, you know, sort of very clear-sighted. And a lot of it would have been written in advance, and then when they die, they're updated. My job is to write something as quickly as possible in order for it to be on the website, or at least in the newspaper the next day.
Yeah.
And with Bowie, I had to write a major feature on, you know, it ended up being a little bit of personal reflection, you know, trying to place him in the culture and explain his significance. And so it was the opposite of the sober, sensible obituary. It was reactive. And I know a lot about Bowie, so I can draw on my own interpretation, but I'd never met him, I never interviewed him, so really it was a kind of fan letter, you know. So then as the year passes, I mean, I've been called on to write about Bowie so much, you know, from the, I think there's the Lazarus play, which wasn't very good actually, to the album which came out just before he died, which I thought was brilliant, to actually, I really liked the Lazarus album, the soundtrack, you know, there's always things going on, to these concerts last weekend. So you're constantly reassessing in a way. But you know, the strange thing with Bowie, I mean, I couldn't, you know, you could take a negative view and sort of fight against all the sort of endless praise. But then I couldn't really do that because I completely love Bowie.
Yeah.
So actually it'd be totally false.
And does it, with all of the sort of activity, the kind of extracurricular Bowie sort of related activity that's happened over the last year, does it make you as a music fan, as a Bowie fan, just want to kind of go home and stick on Hunky Dory or Young Americans or one of the classics and actually just inhabit that world for 45 minutes of a great record?
Right now I'm getting a bit sick of it actually.
Yeah.
I've just heard so much. I mean, I think because last weekend was so dominated by Bowie, and also this feeling, it's the difficult thing with someone like Bowie, in particular Bowie, much more than most pop stars, is that people felt that they own them. I mean, I remember the first time I heard Hunky Dory, and it was in this country cottage, and I was the oldest, there's my friend's older sister, I had a terrible crush on her, you know, so it felt so incredibly personal.
Yeah.
But that's the same for everyone. And so then you kind of, it's a very difficult thing, because then you go along and you see all these other people who all feel like the children of Bowie themselves. And you think, hang on a sec.
Hang on, it's mine first.
And you go, yeah, it's mine first. Exactly. You go, oh no, he is the most famous rock star in the world. No, he's not mine. You know, so you have to, that these are all the things that you're kind of dealing with. But as a journalist, I'm trying to assess it. So again, I keep coming back to this concert, which I just felt was not good. And it felt like a kind of celebrity karaoke, more to do with these people wanting to kind of put themselves in Bowie's shoes, which you cannot do. But it's really down, you know, it's down to the event. I mean, I felt that Lorde was very good when she did Life on Mars. Yeah. I didn't think that Lady Gaga was very good when she did her, was it Starman?
Yeah.
She did the Grammys, didn't she? Not that she's hasn't got great things to offer, but it just didn't work. So you have to disassociate. You cannot, and I think a lot of journalists have been doing this, a lot of journalists are guilty of this. You cannot say, well, Bowie's wonderful, so everything, all the children of Bowie are wonderful too.
Yeah.
You know, you have to separate that.
Maybe music criticism is not equipped with the arsenal to kind of properly kind of pay homage, but also be realistic about some of these. But, you know, Prince was more soberly deconstructed. George Michael was soberly deconstructed. Leonard Cohen, who was a great songwriter, was much more soberly deconstructed and assessed, I suppose, after their deaths. You know, more minor artists, I suppose. But I suppose when someone of that stature dies, everyone is racing to the thesaurus for their superlatives.
I think there's something about Bowie in particular, though, because Leonard Cohen, I'd say, is pretty much as famous. Mm. In terms of his writing, I'd say he was, you know, on an equal scale. I'd say lyrically probably better. It's not nearly as obtuse. You know, you understand what the messages are, and they go to the heart of humanity. If you listen to Suzanne or any of those songs. So I don't know. I mean, I think there was something about... There's something about Bowie which made people feel that they had a special relationship with him. And it's different with George Michael's. George Michael's death was a tragedy. You know, he died pretty young. Bowie wasn't so young. But, you know, with George Michael, he was also a mainstream pop star. Apparently a very, very nice guy. The death came out of the blue, for those of us who didn't know him, at least. But it wasn't the same. You know, I think every now and then it's the same as Princess Diana. It's where, you know, and you'll get sort of very cynical newspaper reports saying, oh, this outpouring of grief for someone you never knew is so phony. But it's not. It's the same thing as having a kind of, you know, crying at a movie that you love. You know, it's a way of expressing emotion in a way that isn't going to hurt you, you know. Because most of us didn't know Bowie personally.
These are well enough constructed stories. They're real life, but they're well enough constructed real lives to be better than fiction and as emotional as, some fantastic film.
Exactly.
A roller coaster. Okay, well, thank you very much for shining your light on the world of sort of pop music obituaries and Bowie in particular. How could we escape that elephant in the room? Why would we want to?
Yeah, you can't escape it. But it will change. You know, and I think there's going to be a time. I think, you know, when someone dies, it's like I said, everything they did is suddenly great. So Rick Parfitt dies, and suddenly status quo, did were great. But really, status, you know, I like status quo to an extent, but they weren't in a great place before he died. They weren't being seen as an important band, important part of the culture. So that happens immediately, and I think it takes, with someone like David Bowie, probably takes a year or maybe 2 years before we can start saying, actually, he had his weaknesses. Of course he did. He was an experimental artist. And so how could you not? Experiments, by their very nature, mean that some things work and some things don't.
And I like the idea of reassessing it. Reassessing someone album by album is for a recording artist, there is no more fair way of doing it.
I think that's true. And I think, I think people will be listening to Hunky Dory in 50 years' time. They're probably not going to be listening to Tin Machine in 50 years' time. They're not listening to it now. So, you know, things change all the time. And you know, different things from the past have relevance all of a sudden. I mean, who would have thought that jazz is coming back? You know, jazz was seen as this moribund and dead form, but it's having a complete huge revival. Partly, you know, La La Land is a sort of jazz-based film. Mm. And David Bowie made a jazz-based album before he died, you know, which is great. You know, this is exciting, improvisational music. Why shouldn't it survive? But it was seen as something pre-rock and roll.
So our tip to the wise is invest in tap shoes this year, I think.
Yeah, maybe.
Will Hodgkinson, as ever, thank you very much. In the fear of amen. In the fear of amen. Stands a solitary candle. We've heard that writing a good obituary is a work of clear-eyed historical judgment that allows for keeping in the best bits, the naughty bits, the warts and all, but not so many warts that family and friends left behind aren't left spitting feathers. So how do you write an obituary? With firmness, fairness and a certain joie de vivre. We all know what that's code for, don't we? You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was the rose-tinted Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week for a behind-the-scenes look at the new issue of Monocle, which is available now on all good news stands. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.